North Coast, or it's not North Coast, like,
All right, guys. Well, you want to go ahead and get rolling here?
He's definitely more
Are you dialed in?
Yep, all dialed in and everything.
Okay. I have no idea the rhyme or reason.
I don't know if a couple of matches were tied up today.
Okay.
So I don't necessarily expect them. I think they're on the
phone.
Yeah,
okay.
All right. Is there anybody on the phone right now?
You might see around our facilities.
Probably.
Because you're the one going down.
Hey, good morning, Aaron.
Yes.
Are you planning to take notes today?
I'm the pathologist.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Either I'll go or we'll have
And who else was on the phone there?
It just depends on how many people need you.
Brett from South AM.
Hey, Brett.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. Anybody else on the phone? All right. So we'll just go around with the folks here in the room. Start with that end of the table.
Sharp. Cameron, ODFW.
Ryan Kutcher, ODFW.
Andy Trailer with the core.
Jeremy Romer, ODFW.
Chad Helms, core.
Doug Arnold, core.
Sarah Bjork, ODFW, Fish Health.
All right. And then on the phone, we had Brett and Aaron. All right. Well, welcome back to HMT, folks. Hey, Sarah.
Hi.
Jeremy, welcome. I don't know if you guys have been here in the past, but haven't seen your faces in the more recent meetings, but yeah, thanks for joining today. So hopefully we can reconvene at a more regular interval. I know the past couple months have been kind of irregular with the holidays and with some other folks in and out of the office and other things going on. So we have a couple of older action items to follow up on. The first one was the hoist breaker at Minto. That breaker was not very accessible when it trips, and so we were looking at either putting in some kind of platform so that folks could reach it a little easily, more easily, or some kind of man basket so that folks could actually just get into a lift of some sort and access it that way. And we looked at both those options. It sounded like it was going to be too difficult to move the breaker to the ground level. That's what we got from Jim Butler and the maintenance crew out there at Detroit. So I don't know, Ryan, if you've talked with Greg, if he has any update on moving a lift truck down there. I know we discussed that back in October.
So the crew brought the man truck down.
Mm-hmm.
It was there. I was there a month ago, and the truck was still there, but it sounded like it was going to go back to Detroit soon.
Right.
And once it went back, there was no plan to have the truck there. And really no other plan, at least that Greg was aware of, moving forward. So,
okay.
If it's still there, I would be surprised based on the conversation Greg had with Jim and company at Detroit. So if it were to, I mean, obviously it's not in use much now.
Sure.
But as we get into trapping and sorting Chinook, we do run the risk of having that thing trip.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I will follow back up with those maintenance guys at Detroit and see. We were talking about renting a truck at some point, renting a lift truck, just to have it out there permanently. And then look at kind of the time frame for building access, like a little walkway and a platform to get up to that breaker. It doesn't seem like it would be that complicated, but the way that contracting works around here, it'll be next decade. So that'll be an action item for me to follow up on which plan we decided to pursue going forward and then kind of a timeline. And then, Brett, while you're on the phone with us, we've talked about whether or not we have a similar situation at Foster. I think we probably do, with the breaker for the actual hoist for the hopper being mounted up on that elevated rail. Do you know off the top of your head if that is the case?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
And then also we have the wire coming off the pinnet has pulled kind of down out of the box up there. There's some exposed, they're not exposed wires, but I mean the casing around the wiring is pulled down. So we've documented it and we've let staff know, but it's still, that situation's still there as well.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Put it on our crane.
Cool. Great. Okay. The next action item we had was biosecurity at Marion Forks. Sarah, I assume that is why you are here.
Indeed.
I know that you went out there and kind of did an inspection and looked at stuff and then wrote up a report. Tom sent that to me last week. I haven't sent it out to the larger HMT group. But do you want to give us a recap and kind of talk about what you found?
Yeah, so historically, before I started covering Marion Forks as the pathologist, Tony and Manny was there. And we go and we do monthly fish health checks, and then we do pre-lib checks before the fish get sent out. And Marion Forks had always been super clean. Like, they'd occasionally have a few external parasites, which is a typical thing that happens. We would still do screening and checking for BKD, bacterial kidney disease, just because that's one of our pathogens that we monitor for, because it's a slow-growing chronic bacteria that can harm the fish. And it was always either undetectable or really, really small amounts after the fish had gone down to Minto. And so right after I took over for Tony, I was doing just my regular workup, and I cut into a fish. This was 2000, I'll have to double check. I think 2013 was the first year. Right, that was the same year. Kansas, right, that the first year that fish were passed up above?
Fish weren't passed, but fish managed to get up above the weir on Marion Creek.
Yes, so I didn't mean pass above the weir. I mean, but they were passed up above the dams, oh. And hence came.
That's been going on for years and years.
Oh, okay. So. Well, for some reason, and that
the weir,
year...
The weir on Marion Creek failed because the channel changed with a high flow event back in, like, 2011.
Okay.
So the weir that they had there, the placement of the weir that they had there was leaking, so fish could get around it. So now we've moved the weir up to just at the intake, mm-hmm. and that appears to be fish tight. We have a sample size of 1 year.
Yes.
Yay!
Yes. So from what Cam was describing of the when they first came past the weir, almost immediately in those smolts, I'm doing my exams and I get, a sample of dead fish and BKD. Whereas before, fish were not dying from bacterial kidney disease and would only barely be picking it up with, really sensitive tests. So that went on low level loss that year, and we knew, the hatchery had seen adults going up past the weir. So we said, okay, we know exactly what the source is. What can we do to try to modify the weir? I think that put some plans into place. And the next year, again, the same thing happened. And some of it, when the channel changes or weather conditions, floods, that can't be, completely prevented. But again, it happened, and we had BKD in the smolts again. And then the following year, instead of picking up BKD in the smolts, which would be starting in December, January, February, and before release, I found BKD in our juvenile fish starting in August. And that is before any adult fish would have come up and gotten past that weir. And that indicated that the resident fish in Marion Creek were probably now BKD positive.
And when was that, Sarah?
Let me look in here. It was August, I think, in 2000.
It's no big deal if you
August
can't get to it quick.
2014 or 2015.
Yeah.
I say in 2015.
Okay.
About it in the juvenile fish. And so that was the worst year where then the disease progressed because the fish were smaller. There was this longer period of time that the bacteria was replicating and spreading between fish to fish. And so by that winter and into the spring, we actually had epizootic loss, which is 0.1% per day. And we actually had some difficulty of where we could transfer the fish or when we could release them, because it's our policy that we don't release, any fish that are experiencing epizootic. And then from what we had tested and what the hatchery estimated, let me see what they said their percent loss was. Sorry, I'm not finding the detail now to look at it. I want to say that they had a significant loss, like more than 30%.
Yes.
Then, I think it was, it's in the report. But and then they also had a 50% prevalence. So, and that's just out of what we subsample. And that's pretty bad news, because bacterial kidney disease is a slow-growing chronic bacteria, and it could still be affecting the fish, you know, how they can handle coming in salt water. For the fish that come back that have BKD, that's what we do our ELISA culling program on, because there's horizontal transmission of the bacteria from fish to fish, but then also vertical from the female to go into the eggs. So we already have control over preventing the bacteria from coming into the eggs, and everything that goes to Marion Forks from Minto has been screened, and they're only negative eggs. So what we're picking up at Marion Forks is definitely from Marion Creek, from the water supply. The year that they had the epizootic, we can use erythromycin, which is an antibiotic that goes into the feet, but erythromycin has to be used for 4 weeks of feeding, and the fish have to eat a pretty decent percentage per day, which when they're smolts and they're, you know, they're big fish, it's cold temperatures, and eating this medicated feed for a month is a pretty long period of time for a feed that's considered fairly unpalatable. At the time of the epizootic, if Marion Forks were to try to treat everything on station that was sick, which was every pond, it would have been over $70,000. And unfortunately, for treating smolts with the erythromycin, they just won't eat it. You can throw it into the pond, and just based on the physiology of the fish, they'd rather hold off on eating from they'd rather just not eat. So then you're wasting the money. And
sure.
They did a test group of two ponds, and it just didn't make any difference. The fish wouldn't eat enough of the medicated feed to make a difference. So since then, last year, we implemented feeding the fish around June, the erythromycin medicated feed, because we knew that the same inputs up above coming through Marion Creek, it's going to be about the same. And we didn't have epizootic loss in the smolts. I did pick up some bacterial kidney disease, some clinical disease, but it's more typical of what happens at other places where we have positive fish in the water supply, where, meaning we don't have a significant amount of loss, with a few dead fish that I come and examine every month, I find bacterial kidney disease in half or more of them. So the pathogen is still present, but we were able to keep it at a manageable level, such that when we were transferring smolts out this spring, we didn't have any issues. They transferred well. They didn't, you know, die upon arrival, and we didn't have that really bad chronic loss. So, with increasing the plans to increase more returns and getting fish above the dams, the reintroduction plans, there's just more and more risk building of fish at the hatchery. So we know that the spring Chinook have brought back some bacterial kidney disease, and how long that's going to be present in the population that's supplying the water into Marion Forks, we don't know. It might taper off. It might stay the same. We could treat with the erythromycin. This year, Chris said it was about $11,000 to treat that. So this is not a cheap drug to use. And again, it's for 4 weeks, which is a pretty long time. But just as an example, some of our other bacterial pathogens, it's a 10-day treatment. The Chinook, we know that that happened. We've got a new weir in, and that has been keeping them out. But as we said before, the old weir we thought was pretty good and was going to work, but things change. So with Gunnar Steelhead being the next lineup and plan of coming back, they bring a whole new set of pathogen risks, specifically infectious hematopoietic necrosis virus. If that were to get into the facility, spring Chinook are not as susceptible to the virus as rainbow trout and steelhead would be, but they can still get infected with it. Looking glass hatcheries have loss in their spring Chinook, and that it depends. Some years they just have the virus, and some years they have significant epizootic loss from it. This year, Bonneville and their fall Chinook had IHNV, and again, they had pretty significant loss, and that affected when they could do some of their transfers of their fish.
Right.
So, you know, the physical barriers can only do so much, and the risk of having adults in the water supply, we all know, is that they're just going to shed pathogens down into the hatchery. Some things we can treat, virus we can't treat for, all you can do is prevent it. You don't know how bad it's going to be or what it's going to happen. Like at South Saniam, they've had, you know, fish go above their the facility for years and years and years, and then last year they had a major IHNV outbreak in the steelhead at the hatchery, and like, well, why was this year the year that happened? Nobody knows. So the safest bet due to the virus exposure is to disinfect the water as well as the other pathogens that are already there. If IHMV were to get in there, A, it could devastate the fish, but B, it would totally change where we can move those fish because we can't move them to areas where the virus is not present, and that would really impact a lot of things, but also the high lake stocking that they do there. They hold over the summer cutthroat, rainbow, and I think brook trout that they put up into those things. And those are pretty small groups. If I think if IHMV were there, it would just kill them all. You know, we're only talking about maybe 5,000 fish, and certainly those fish wouldn't be able to be moved anywhere else. Right now, Marion Forks does a lot for the SAFE program, and that would be pretty detrimental for that, as well as we just don't want to harbor amplify pathogens if it's something that we can put in place to prevent it from happening. So a physical barrier, it works a little bit, but there's still inherent risk. Water disinfection is the safest bet, and that's going to affect fish at all of the life stages. You know, it'll be beneficial to fry for smolts.
Extremely unlikely that we could hold that when you're during minuscule data, extreme migration.
It
just can't be done.
Yeah, as well as, sorry, Cam, I didn't even mention the, you know, the feasibility aspect of it. Marion Creek, as have you guys been up there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
So, you know, it's a small mountain creek, flashy things happening, things coming down. Chris, the assistant manager there, was talking about, you know, when they're having big water events, they're constantly cleaning stuff off. You know, there's how effective the weir can be. Is the weir going to be blown out in the safety of people constantly trying to prevent that from getting clogged up?
Sure.
So that's where we really advocate for some kind of water disinfection. You know, it's a pretty expensive thing to take on, but it would be, you know, beneficial in many, many aspects.
Yeah, for sure. And I apologize because I haven't read through your report yet, but do you recommend specific type of water disinfection treatment? Are you thinking like UV in combination with drum screens or some mixture of both or something else?
A drum screen with UV would be the best because you need to get the particulates out for the UV to have the clearest water to be able to go through. And the reason a drum filter alone wouldn't be able to cut it is viruses are the tiniest of our pathogenic, you know, of our pathogens. And
right.
You're not going to get a drum filter that's going to be able to keep that out.
Yeah.
But whereas the UV is, you know, if you have clear enough water, it's pretty potent. And that can take care of, you know, viruses, bacteria, and some parasites.
Right.
And so we had, you know, I didn't go into much more detail of what the type of system would be other than drum with UV.
Okay.
You know, 150 millijoules per second per centimeter squared. And that just kind of takes there's a broad range of irradiation that bacteria, parasites, and viruses need. And so that kind of goes on the higher end where you know you're going to get just about everything.
Okay. So then this is all with Marion Creek.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as Horn Creek goes, we feel like
Horn Creek is pretty safe. Yeah, it's done very well. There's the cement barrier where they haven't been seeing fish get into that. The problem is water temperature and I think water availability. And with Horn Creek, it's so cold that they have a really hard time getting fish the size that they need to. Because that was one of the other early recommendations that we made is Marion Creek's been compromised as far as pathogen inputs. Let's use Horn Creek and, you know, the hatchery's ability to estimate growth rates and where they want them to be to meet, you know, production just got totally shifted.
Yeah.
The fish were so small and they're trying really hard to catch them up.
Sure. But in implementing a system like this, we would just focus on the Marion Creek intake water. We wouldn't necessarily want to couple it onto Horn Creek.
Nope, I think just Marion.
Cool.
And what, and I know that we've brought this up, is there any, what is the Corps' general take on, I don't know, implementing something like this or planning it out or?
I think it'd be a good idea. I mean, I've said before, I think that hatchery is in a pretty good spot as far as like just geographically where it's located, and it's pretty high elevation. So, you know, looking at kind of the 20, 50 year outlook with climate change and warming waters and everything, it's like what hatcheries are going to be usable, what hatcheries are going to be maybe safer. And that's one in my mind that I think could be around for quite a while and would be pretty useful. So investing in it makes sense to me at this point. You know, we talked about $1.5 million is kind of a rough estimate for what we think it would take. And I forget, Ryan, was that equipment and install kind of construction? Or was did that include design at all?
And obviously I think that's where we would probably start with design. That, quite frankly, that's a number that we all sat around and said, well, you know, trying to look at some comparable systems that we designed. We had spent a number of years, but we worked through, I think, when Tony was still around, designing a system at Lieberg. That was a bigger, it was a 100 CFS system. It was kind of that $2.5 to $3 million estimate in like 2008 dollars. So 1.5 might even be a little low, but I think it's to that magnitude anyway. You know, $2 million or something like that. But I think what we'd want to, my thought would be next step, would fund a design, whether it's, I don't know, on some of the cores folks would look at, or a contract with our engineers to do, or a or a third party, I guess, might be an option.
So Sarah, I mean, as far as like how that would go in the future, we do our budgets kind of in a 2-year cycle, so we can plan 2 years ahead of time, and so we can make a request. So we're in FY17 now, so FY19 funding, we can make a request then to include $2 million or something like that, to start some of that design work and maybe even start some of the construction, depending on how the design would go. And whether that's a contract with the state or through a third party or whatever else, and our engineers may be interested in designing something like this too, or at least helping to kind of cut those costs and have to contract out less. So that's kind of how it would go, with the estimate, and then put it into the budget, and then it's no guarantee that we'll get it funded. You can always ask for it. But if we could get it funded, then in 2 years from now, potentially we could start design on something like that.
And one of the things related to cost, and I don't know what it'd be, is running UV can be expensive energy-wise on a maintenance level. Is that something that the Corps takes on, or Ryan, that ODFW takes on?
That's good. That's a good question. I mean, at this point, I don't know that there's a clear answer.
That's just something to throw out, as far as I know. It's a fairly expensive.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then,
like, increasing the power bill every month. Yeah.
So an operational cost increase. I guess the other piece that I think that would be tied into the system and the design would be backup power, as their power is sketchy, to say the least. It's not a reliable power source, so we definitely want
it can be spotty.
A backup power generation system.
Andy, you're thinking on a 2-year time frame, basically, before anything really would happen?
Yeah.
Any thoughts on trying to get the funding for design work ahead of that, Andy?
Yeah, so I was going to say, if we can accomplish this in like a little bit smaller chunks of money, sometimes around the end of the year, we can have a couple $100,000 to throw at something. So if we could initiate some amount of the design with 200, 300K, then that's something that we might be able to do if it's available this year. It looks like it's not. We're already short in some of our programs. But maybe next year, you know, if we come up with surplus, this could be one of the options we utilize that surplus dollars in.
Okay.
So it just kind of depends who's doing the work and whether or not they can bite off part of that apple and then pick it back up at a later date. That's kind of hard to do with the contract. Like, if we contracted with an A&E firm or something, it'd be difficult for them to do. If it was something that our engineers or your engineers were doing in-house and then could dust it off later in 6 months and pick it back up, that'd be a little bit easier.
Yeah.
And it sounds like your guys already have some familiarity with designing these systems or looking at what would go into it.
Yeah, we've got
at Lieberg or elsewhere.
Yeah. I don't know if we put any new systems in recently. Do you know of any?
Not for you.
Yeah, okay. But we do have some of our folks are familiar with them and have.
Cold Rivers would maybe the more recent one that's put in UV mean, that's just going into their hatch house.
Right. And that's another conversation we had, was redesigning that system. Much smaller system, so I think we came up to about $0.5 to $0.75 million just to treat their hatch house.
Okay.
But again, a much smaller system. So.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I'll go back to my boss and some of the folks that put together our budget and talk about pros and cons. I've already briefed them on some of the stuff before, and I think they've all seemed supportive, especially that it goes towards the mission of being able to reintroduce fish up above the dams, which is kind of the end goal for everybody. So if that's the way I got to sell it, that's the way I got to sell it. And then I'll report back out to you guys as far as including that in the FY19 budget. Let's see if that works.
Sounds good.
All right. Let's see, what else do we have here? So the next action item that was left over from previous meetings was the Foster ladder attraction issue that we've looked at. And then we had a couple presentations at the Willamette Science Review that talked about this a little bit. But the action here was actually that NOAA, I think Ed Meyer maybe, had some low cost suggestions to help regarding tunnel lighting. And NOAA was going to forward these recommendations, and they never did, as far as I know. I can follow back up with Lance.
Yeah.
And Ed.
Hey, Andy, this is Lance Kruzik. I got on during the previous discussion.
Oh, hey, Lance. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning, all. So, yeah, this is the first time I'm seeing this. I remember I had sent an email to you saying that Ed had some ideas, but I haven't followed up with him. But if that's something the group's interested in, yeah, I can certainly do that.
Yeah, I think that'd be good. And then also, maybe we should just brainstorm, maybe revisit some of those presentations from the Science Review, and maybe brainstorm if that would still be helpful or not, given some of the stuff that was presented there. I don't remember all of it off the top of my head, but maybe for next month, could review some of that stuff and talk about how we'd want to proceed.
And I believe that U of I's thoughts on altering the ladder water supply or use of the water in the ladder is ongoing too. I haven't got a clear idea of what they're actually proposing, but that's going to happen within a month too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a little bit of pushback on some of Ed's ideas.
Yeah.
Brett, way in here, but the idea that you could increase attraction into the ladder by having bright lights in the ladder, that flies in the face of reason. So I'd like to hear what the whole suite of ideas is.
What I heard initially from Ed, I think, was some of those tunneled areas that were covered underneath concrete roadway and walkway and stuff looked like big dark black holes. And so trying to have a more consistent kind of daylight lighting scenario instead of real variable bright light, dark K, bright light. But I don't know exactly what he was talking about.
Okay.
So we generally find that fish like coals and tunnels and swim towards those things. But yeah, I think definitely worth a discussion.
So yeah, Lance, if you want to follow back up with Ed and then send that out to the group, that would be sweet.
Okay, we'll do.
All right, so that brings us to updates. Marion Forks and Minto. What do you got?
I don't think, Greg, you're not on the phone, are you? Yeah, he's up. He's out of the office today. I don't really have any updates. There are some issues. I think everybody was pretty aware of the TDG issues a month ago. Chris Walker sent an email yesterday. They sound like there was a brief outage. Greg has been tracking that pretty close. Has been an issue. We did release the first group of summer steelhead a little bit early, and then delayed bringing the other ones on.
Right.
So some operational challenges there. Greg bought a small monitoring unit, so it's set up, I think, in the pre-sort, so he's able to track at least their minto. I think he's recording that daily, and then comparing that to Niagara. And it seems like it's about a 10 percentage point decrease in that stretch from Niagara down to Minto, which is reasonable, I guess, expected.
So I saw an email from Greg to Chris and me, and he was talking about getting that thing installed at Minto.
Yeah.
Is that still something that needs to be done, or has he installed it himself?
Yes, and I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's, I think there was a way that Greg was trying to tie it. I think what he wants to do is tie it into the...
He wants to get it into the PLC, so you can kind of see it remotely on the screen.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right now, it's just a sitting with it with a on station display.
Okay.
On the unit on the pre-switch.
I gotcha. So he wants the fancy computer system piece.
Yeah, which then you could, I would suspect, set some parameters and alarm parameters or monitoring parameters, which would make sense. I mean, I think that's what the unit's designed to be able to do anyway.
Okay.
So
that'd be pretty sweet.
I think that was the request, although, I think that's where we're at.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's probably less Detroit maintenance crew and more electrical engineering PLC folks.
Okay. So can you circle back with Greg? And
I can, yeah.
Chris? Okay.
Either Chris or myself will.
Okay. Other than that, Mary Force, relatively good survival on Chinook, at least better than past years with some of the issues that Sarah pointed out, BKD and just high egg mortality in general. So things are looking good. Lots of snow at the hatchery. It's been a light year up there, a light winter.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll be glad when winter's over, like the rest of us. So.
Yeah. When's that second group of summer steelhead going to come down? Do you know? Yeah.
They are. So they came down after that earlier high DDG issue was resolved. So
okay.
They're now. They should be there, I think, through the end of the month.
Okay.
That's all I've got.
All right. All right, Brett. How about a South San Am and Foster update?
So things are going okay over here. South San Am, we released all of our fish, so all our juveniles, I guess our yearlings. So the steelhead, we're just about to wrap up the volitional release, and they went out really well. We fed that transfer diet again this year, and that seemed to have a good result again with that. So they're definitely out. We ponded all of our steelhead fry have been ponded for about a month now, and they're doing very well. Knock on wood, no signs of cold water or anything at DBS, and they're growing well and eating well. And we're just kind of taking care of some winter maintenance here at the hatchery in between. At Foster, the maintenance crew over there is been working on getting the fish lock and braille system back into operation. So I guess yesterday or the day before, they just installed the new braille. And now they're working on getting the bulkhead motors and lifting assemblies installed. So hopefully here in a week or so, that'll be all installed and we can do some testing and make sure we get everything really operating well before we start the adult season. Really slow, as everybody knows, on the adult collection numbers for winter steelhead. The false counts are really low. We've only had 7 winters up here so far. They're over there. Kenny's over there today working the trap. There's 1 or 2 fish in there again. And we just continue to check the trap daily. And as soon as we get a fish in there, we make arrangements and research and get it hauled upstream. We did see some erosion again at the Riverbend site. And our outplant site, we're still able to safely use it this year, but we did, we lost some more bank. But anyway, I think we've been working with you, Andy, a little bit on that in the lease to try to hopefully get a solution there and see what we can do to try to stabilize that bank so we don't lose that site in the future. And other than that, business as usual.
Cool. Yeah, I haven't forgotten about that site at Riverbend. Just been tied up with this contract stuff, so I haven't had a chance.
Yeah.
But All that stuff should resolve itself here within the next month or two. So by June, hopefully be able to jump on that. I'd like to get something done this summer while they have a chance to work on it.
We have we can talk about offline, but there's a youth watershed council that works with the Forest Service that would probably volunteer some time to help with some things. So
yeah,
that'd be a good opportunity too. So anyway, there's some options there.
Cool. Yeah, I'll follow up with you later on.
Okay, sounds good.
Cool. Thanks, man.
Yep.
All right, Kinsey.
No update.
No update.
I'm here too.
Oh, Kurt is on.
Hey, Kurt.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Pretty good.
So our fry are doing excellent. They're, last week Sarah was here for a health check, and we had trouble even finding any mortality for her, but she took what she had and found them to be in really great shape. So that's good. All of our releases have been completed by now. Our last release was like March 23rd, I believe. And every release, we had three different ones, February 1st of March, and then March 23rd. We reset a little bit early just because Eva was bringing the canal down our water supply, so we just let them go a little early. But they hit the water with great flows. I think everybody experienced that this year, so we're hoping for good things in the future, obviously. Bird predation was really low on those releases. I think the second one, they kind of found them a little bit, but the water raised, rose up, and they couldn't find it for a while. So that was a good thing, because they really can handle them at the end of our fish lateral re-release. But yeah, we're still looking for them. I still see them down there a little bit, but we tear them away a little bit. So E-Web, as I mentioned, did take the canal down last week of March, and they just started bringing it up this week. It's an annual thing they do. Our intake is on that canal. And they were doing some maintenance, but it was a little bit longer this year because of some repairs they had to do on the canal wall downstream. One thing they did do, they had a contractor trim the sides of the canal of all brush and trees for about 2 miles. There was just so much debris in the, he took the large stuff out, but a lot of stuff fell into the canal. Thankfully, when they started bringing it back up over the weekend and through the first few days this week, the flow has swept that all down there to their operations and not ours. So that's a good thing. There was so much debris. We took advantage of that canal being down to install a flow meter on the main pipeline. This is installed near the site last year, which at this time was all dug up and being adapted to the Cottonwood Creek pipeline being introduced sooner before it gets down here near the pond. So both those flow meters are in. The Cottonwood Creek one is working. That was installed last year. We're still in the process of getting this one actually reading some flow. Harry's got to come down from engineering and do some calculations on it or something. But it is installed, so that's a good thing. What else we got? We've been working towards getting the trap ready, some cleanup down there, some adjusting of some of the equipment. We hope to open May 1st, and I think that'll be something we'll do. So that'll be coming up in just a few days. And getting the lighting project off the floor, or off the ground, I should say. Talked to the contractor today. Some of their guys are a little bit farther ahead than we are, but we should have that going very soon. He's going to come down to the next week and we'll get that started. That's the energy initiative that the Corps has put in place for all the Corps facilities. So that's starting to go.
Cool.
So we're going back to hydrogen peroxide for our fungus control on the adult fish. We were doing formalin last year, which we haven't done for 15 years or so. So we have a real fine line of making the DEQ parameters that we need to go by in our guidelines. So rather than risk, some violations, we're going to go back to home hydrogen peroxide. The reason we went away from it was all the homeland security stuff. Now that a lot of these other facilities have gone through it, they've actually streamlined the process a bit, so I'm getting in the back door there with a little streamlining, so which I find to be very helpful. But we should have that in place, where we're going to store it, and also secure it the way they want it, and so we're working towards that also.
Kurt, will the
Hydrogen peroxide treatment be applied to all fish, including hatchery origin fish held for outplanting?
Yes. Yes, we will do. We're going to hold some Willamette stock too, so we'll have all of that going on with both ponds getting the hydrogen peroxide treatment.
That's actually really interesting. Okay, so Sarah, you're aware of the issue with the Willamette stock Chinook transported to McKenzie Hatchery for holding. The Willamette stock died in droves at McKenzie while Kurt's brood did not.
Yes.
They're repeating that. If the same thing happens, there's a really interesting thing happening we just don't understand. There's some exposure or something is happening to the fish that hang a left on the middle fork. It's different from the fish that hang a left on the McKenzie just downstream.
Mm-hmm.
I'm at a loss.
Yeah, we don't have an idea of what the big difference is. It's something that we haven't investigated any more yet. I can go back to Craig and see how much we want to look into it since this year it's happening again. One of the big things that was killing the Willamette fish at McKenzie was C. shasta, which is a myxozoan parasite. There's no fish-to-fish transmission. The parasite has a complex life cycle where the fish essentially have to swim through an area where the infectious stage of the parasite is being released, and then they get infected. It goes into the gills, into the bloodstream, and then to the organs, usually the intestine, or the liver, which was one of the big things that was killing fish. So you'd think, all right, here's McKenzie fish, here's Willamette fish, fish going to Dexter. They're pretty much following the same migration, right? Okay, so I guess that's a question is, there could be two differences. Either they, they're following the same, they hook into the McKenzie, they've had maybe some exposure to sea shasta, which we do get some sea shasta at McKenzie. And then maybe the Willamette fish are going through a big hot spot of it as they go up to Dexter. And then once they're infected, then they get transferred to McKenzie. Even though McKenzie has nice colder water, they're still going to die from that parasite. They're not going to recover from it. That's definitely not going to happen. Or the difference could be further up in the Willamette, further downstream in the Willamette or in the Columbia, if they're migrating through at different times, that would be where they could get different exposures to the parasite. Another thing that the fish that get to Dexter tend to have, McKenzie fish do not have, and this is definitely a water temperature, water quality issue, is heavy, heavy columnaris, which is a bacterial pathogen that gets onto the gills. We can do injections where we try to treat it, but if the load is too high, it's just not going to happen, they're not going to recover from it. So at McKenzie, when they were dying, it was primarily, from what I picked up in the fish, C. shasta and some columnaris. I don't know if this year it's going to come out to be the same way. When I have talked to Craig about it, the old data, which now is going on 10 years old, was that the Willamette was not infectious for C. shasta much north of Corvallis. I think that potentially could be very different based on what we're seeing from the McKenzie fish and the fish that are going up to Dexter. And the support that I have for that is there are a lot of places where we didn't think the parasite existed, like Clackamas. It didn't show up until 2007. It was a Clackamas hatchery that's been online since the 80s, I think. So it took over 25 years for that to show up and be a problem. And what the big difference seems to be of why that change happens, the best hypothesis is the habitat for the alternate host of the parasite, which is this little tiny worm. It's about the size of an eyelash. Actually, it's a sediment tube-dwelling worm, like it's little boulders, in gravel, some fine sediments. As that habitat changes, these worms literally can set up on like a carpet, multiple millions. If you have susceptible fish hosts coming by or picking up the parasite and then also dying and shedding the parasite back down to those worms, it just sets up this perfect cycle. So it would be really interesting I don't know where the money for any kind of sampling or studies would come, if we resampled along the Willamette to see where these more infectious hotspots are. But unfortunately, that's not, even if we know that's the cause, it's not going to change the outcome for our fish.
Yeah, so
we can't treat for
such asthma. Like, what do you do about it if you do know where the hotspots exist?
Yeah, I don't
much
have an idea for there. So sorry, Tim. No. I answer your questions with questions.
Hmm.
Do you think, like, answering where of why it's happening, what do you think that would help point us in the direction of something, or would it just be a good
It's always good to know why something is happening, but it's only going to get funded if there is a management implication.
Yeah.
If we can predict an answer and what our action would be to resolve the problem.
Yeah.
So if you've got a bunch of money hanging around that you just like to spend on finding out something academic,
well,
great.
I will say one of the possibilities is management, but again, how much wiggle room as far as how the river is managed is there? Is if when the fish are migrating, you can spill water to dilute out some of that parasite, that is a possibility. But can you, this is out of what I know as far as the hydraulics thing, can you actually spill enough water to make a big enough difference? For a Chinook, the infectious dose of to cause a lethal infection can be as many as 10 spores per liter of water. And so if we pick up, say, 100 spores per liter of water in a certain stretch, if you can't dilute that water 10 times, is it, or say that infectious zone lasts for several miles, I don't know. But if we only see it as, a smaller window, I don't know how the dams are regulated enough if that's even an option. I know in areas like Klamath, it's something that they've tried to use as a management tool specifically for that parasite.
A potential management change would be earlier collection of broodstock, right? Get those fish out of the river sooner, assuming that we had adequate broodstock holding facilities, which is a whole separate issue in the middle.
Trouble is that the mortality on Mackenzie-held Willamette stock happened on fish that were transferred in May. You can't sort of get much earlier. May 18 is the earliest they'll open the trap. So fish, well, I don't know for a fact that they can't open the trap earlier. It's possible, I suppose.
At Dexter?
Yeah.
I think they're confined by trying to get things cleaned up, like they need to have that water off so that they can pressure wash and get everything.
After they release their juveniles.
Exactly.
Right.
That's happening now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a tricky one.
Yeah, I would say that using my best predictor, having this nice big winter with huge flushing flows should help eliminate some of that polychaete habitat, whether it the fish are getting infected in the Columbia or along the Willamette. Hopefully this year will be a better year for some of that habitat maybe has been scoured out, so hopefully the infectious units that are being released is going to be a little bit lower, but also having cooler water temperatures and the infectious units that are being released are going to be diluted out. I'm hoping this year's going to be a better year than when that happened.
I would think so, Sarah. You know, that's a good point, because we've had Willamette stock over here in the past and not had the troubles we had 2 years ago, which was a drought year. So, let's just hope for that, too, because we've had them over here over the years three times, and we didn't have that kind of trouble in a couple other times that we had their stock over here. So we'll do our best to keep them alive. And that's all I have.
I have one thing. You have an interesting group of fish in your trough at the hatchery. I tried to drop in on you unannounced to pick up those otoliths samples the day before yesterday. So
sorry, I missed it.
It's an aside. We have time. There were calico salmon returning to the Mackenzie hatchery. They come back in small numbers most years. I've shared the photos broadly.
I think so, yeah.
So Kurt spawned a boy and a girl.
Oh, yeah.
And they produced offspring, and they're in a trough, and they are the most fascinating group of fish I've seen in a long time. It's great. I photographed, I forgot to bring
them. Are they mostly calicos?
No, they don't have any calico appearance to the fry that are ponded, not quite ponded, they're in the trough now. They appear to be almost albinos at a rate of about, eyeballing it, about a third. So about two-thirds look to have normal pigmentation, and one-third looks to be a uniformly bright orange fish, which I think a kingfisher would just love to see. I mean, it's beautiful fish. They're just gorgeous. Anyway, that's eyeballing at one-third, two-thirds.
Not of the population.
No, of that single cross, so maybe 4,000.
Okay.
They're in a trough.
Yeah.
I haven't done anything with them, because I don't know what to do. What's a reasonable thing?
Feet of the
So we're gonna get a count.
Yeah.
I'm assuming we can pawn them. I'm not sure on that. I'm talking to a geneticist about it. Does it make sense? Because we know that there's something going on with them. But they are viable. They are the very coolest fish I've seen in a long time. And I played with some punnet squares to try to figure out what Mendelian sort of inheritance might contribute to that, given that we had two known calico parents spawned to produce the offspring that aren't all calico or anything like calico.
Yeah.
Anyway, don't do anything with those until I get a chance to get down there early next week, Kurt.
Oh, we'll keep them. Yeah, they're kind of fun to.
Aren't they the coolest?
Pretty much a novelty.
What's the historical take on when the calico started showing up? Is it truly just within the last few years? I mean, not the adults,
juveniles.
You always
see some few different fish through the years, you know, and sometimes that calico look to them, which, you know, when they come back as adults, is really pronounced. I mean, they start to turn that color into the spawning colors. It really gets to be quite vivid, but when they're juveniles, you don't really see that taking hold or really noticeable until they get, you know, 3-4 inches long or so. Then you start noticing them when you're doing samples and stuff, you know. And before that point, we don't really notice them as, I guess it just doesn't show it quite as easily, or maybe just not so different from the other fish. But now the albinos, on the other hand, and that's something that happens. You know, you'll get a few, most years that have some you'll see, and they get, like Candace mentioned, the kingfishers knock them off, we don't see them, they never make it to small size. But that's very few of those. But this year, with a female actually coming back this year, and a couple of males, we decided, let's see what happens here. And Carl Schreck was kind of excited about seeing what the heck would happen too, so, you know, when an OSU professor is excited about it, hey, why not, let's try it.
So the coloration is very, very similar to the cherry salmon, which it is an interesting aside, basically. There's genetic control of it. I'm just academically interested in finding out what's going on with it.
Yeah.
That's just an aside. It's a cool thing that's happening, and it's a fun thing to look at.
Yeah.
Pictures of the adults?
Yeah, I got adults and juveniles, DNA from the adults, got a DNA sample of juveniles. I've got a hard count of normal melanin, normal and non-normal coloration, and try to talk Mark into letting me keep him alive for a while. So Mark objects strenuously as a geneticist to the whole idea that we are propagating something that's clearly not adaptive.
Yeah.
We're not propagating it. I just want to know how.
It's not smushing it out yet.
I mean, it's not like we babied it along in like the show pond tank and then spawned it, and they went out to the ocean and came back.
Yep.
Cam's going to have a line out of his budget for an aquarium in his office.
I got one on the shoulder. No, I got one.
Maybe they can be hollering the sea lions the pinheads can't see.
It is. To my eye, I'd say the adult coloration is very cryptic. I think it would be really, really good for in freshwater habitats anywhere near the margins. It looks like just very mottled, very, very camouflage look to the fish. So as an adult, it might be very adaptive, but
yeah,
for juveniles, bright orange little morsel about that big, not so much.
But as the smolts, the calico ones, as from fish health, usually as fish get sick, they start to have these dark tails and dark spots. And so when you first start to see them, you can distinguish them in the pond, I always go, oh, are they like sloughing, you know, like skin? Are they, you know, getting sick? And you can't catch them. They're totally just with all the other fish, totally behaving pretty normally as far as vigorousness in the pond. But they do stand out. And South Sandium actually had one last year that you could see. Maybe, Brett, are you still there? Maybe more than one, but it was definitely a big minute.
We never did adults back here at Mackenzie, and I've seen these fish for years, but last year we got 6 males, and this year we got a couple males and a female, so hence our experiment.
Well, experiment is a strong word.
Curiosity.
Sorry, I just threw that up. I wanted to
No, thanks. That's interesting stuff. All right, thanks, Kurt.
Yeah.
All right, Chad, I know Cougars. Currently a commission, but
a lot going on at the Cougar right now. Facility is still shut down due to one of the pumps had a slight oil leak. The pump has been pulled out. Our folks are going through it right now. I think they've valve got put back together. I think they replaced the mechanical seal in it, and they're hoping to get it reinstalled next week. So hopefully we'll have the facility back and running. Both units are still out for that the outage for the sump work, so all flow is coming out of the RO still. That outage, I think, is scheduled to be complete May 26th, so hopefully everything stays on schedule and get things back normal up there. So that's all I really have.
Hold on. It'll be back online at the end of May?
May 26th, yeah, both units will be running.
I'm not plugged in enough to bull truck movement at all.
There's a few, Hoagie was saying that there's, I think, two or three radio tech bull trout down below in the tail race there. So, but it's tough when the RO's going. It's hard to compete with that in traction flow. So everything just kind of pulls right up in the RO and hangs out there. So,
well, there's three Chinook over the falls.
Yeah, so we got some really time. Got some time.
As far as Chinook is concerned.
All right. And then how about Fall Creek, Doug?
Oh, well, we fired her up 17th of March, hauled our first haul on the 20th. Of course, no Chinook yet. Two winter steelhead, two males so far that we've collected. That's about it. It's this construction dance of doing our fish operations within the shadow of all of this construction. So we're learning a lot about communication with contractors. RSCI seems to be on or ahead of schedule. We like them. Cool. They communicate well so far. That's kind of where we are. Interesting footnote on the side. In January, we did collect the overwintering Pacific lamprey and screw trap immediately downstream of the facility. We transported that fish above. But it's just been suckers, families of suckers, and trout, really, one whitefish so far. So we'll let y'all know as soon as we get our first Chinook. Doesn't look like we're going to be breaking any early run timing records this year.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, sir. Okay. Lamont, Dexter.
Lamont, things are good. Fish health is good, unless Sarah corrects me, but I think they've had a pretty good spring so far. Good survival with the Chinook program there, no issues. Nothing really else to report at Willamette. Dexter, Tim Wright, who's been there, I guess, forever for all intents and purposes, retired his last day, was in March 31. So he is gone. We had Doug Curtis there in a rotation starting in February, so there was 2 months overlap. Doug will be there at least through April, May. Dan's working on a request to hire and hire approval to get that process moving. We'll keep Doug there as long as we need to until we get the position filled.
Mm-hmm.
But Doug's doing great, fits in well, enjoying the facility. Steep learning curve. I think Tim will come back and help with some of the adult setup and collection because that's Tim's baby, so to speak. So
sure.
Kind of in a definitely a personnel transition there at Dexter.
Yeah.
I worked with him, Doug, this was sampling steelhead, and he's great. Very enthusiastic, very plugged in.
Yep.
Knew what was going on. Thought he pretty much understood most of the valves. Almost all of them.
That's good.
Nice. Knew what all the switches were. It was kind of, it's cool. He works out really well.
Yeah, I think he's a good fit there. Cool. That's all I've got there.
All right.
Lieber, Lieber's kind of like it's limping by. We reduced staffing level there with some of the contract shift stuff going on and trout production. A lot of things are going well, and we're kind of more in limp mode for now as some of this other stuff plays out. So otherwise, no real update for Lieber.
And still planning on, so you guys are kind of in the midst of starting up the big stocking push for the spring.
Yep.
Out of Leeburg and Willamette.
Yep.
Too.
Yeah, I would say under, I think, 58,000 fish left Leeburg this week, I believe. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Nice.
Big push for sure.
Yeah, and then like we talked about with extending that task order, just like the rest of the fish that are on station at Leeburg as of the 1st of July, just focus on stocking those throughout the rest of the year, and then, of course, again the next spring.
Right. Yep. No, that's all planned out and
cool
in the schedule. So
awesome.
I think we're good. Any on that one? Any Anything else you need or contract folks need?
Yeah, I talked to some of our folks, and I think they do want one of the regular budget forms that we get. The SF-424 or something like that? Okay, maybe she did already. I know Ryan McClemon was working it from our end.
Okay, I sent it what she needed Monday morning.
Okay.
I assume she sent it to Ryan. Although I think I may have seen an email. He was out of the office at least Friday. Anyway.
He might have been, yeah. Okay. I'm not totally plugged in on that, but I just took the number that you sent me for the funding for the extension.
Okay.
And put that in, so we should be good to go there.
Okay, yeah, let me know if you need anything else.
Cool, will do.
Hey, this is Lance. I got a question on the Lamidexer stuff.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, one of the things that we've kind of talked about for many, many years is kind of improving the adult holding facilities associated with the Middle Fork Willamette program. And, you know, as we kind of enter in this new consultation that we're working on for the Chinook program, the new HGMPs that you all are aware of, and we've kind of highlighted the need to do something there and don't want to lose sight of that. So as you guys are kind of planning for funding, you know, Andy, 2 years out, those types of things, and then the issues that you guys recently reported with, you know, having to put Willamette Fish over at McKenzie and all of that stuff. But just again, a heads up that, you know, we're going to be wanting to work with all of you closely to figure out what we can do to improve adult holding associated with that program, you know, up at Willamette, Dexter, the whole facility there.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's definitely been something that's on my radar, Lance. We've had money for a couple years allocated in future budgets to try to get funding for replacement of both that broodstock holding pond, but also kind of redoing the intake and the water supply to that pond, because they seem to be kind of linked when we looked into it. So it's definitely been in there. We haven't been able to fund it yet, but we'll keep pushing for it for sure.
Okay. Yeah, maybe just, you know, a heads up to all the agencies and dredge up the previous work that may have been done, maybe by ODFW engineers, whatever. I don't know. I'll talk to Dan about that, see what has been done. But, you know, don't want to lose sight of that. And if there's a way to kind of plan for future budget requests and that, and let's start thinking about that.
For sure. Yeah, I'll check back in and revisit that and make sure that our FY19 submission includes funding for that one. Like I said, I know it's been on there. I think it hasn't been quite the top of the list, but I'll see if I can push it up in priority.
I have a question about that.
Okay.
Is Tim, yes, sir. Tim Wright going to be available to help console on this at all? Because his knowledge would be probably super helpful.
You mean up at Willamette?
At Dexter.
Oh, we're talking about like replacing that dirt, earth, and pond that's up on Willamette.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if needed, I'm sure we could hire Tim back as a consultant.
No, I was saying Dexter, not him. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So good on Lieber, good on Willamette. The last update was just fish counts at the Bennett Dams and Lieberg have been getting Bart's counts.
Yeah, everybody getting those
regularly.
I think everybody that I know is on the list, and Bart's doing a good job keeping it on the Willamette fish counts web page with everything. That'd be 113 steelhead total ascended Bennett, 112 from winter steelhead. Those are lates. You don't get many girdies, so that of the 677 steelhead, winter steelhead over Willamette Falls, something like a half of them or so are considered the late winter steelhead. So call it 350, so a third of the fish are headed to North St. Anne. I think 7 or 8 have been handled at Minto, which leaves the vast majority still in the river down below.
During that high TDG, Gray was taking them downstream to, I want to say, Staten, the period where TDG dropped. Then he did pass a few of those, three or two or three, at Low Pinto, a relatively small number. Mm-hmm. Were collected while KDG was closer to 100.
Okay, let me check on whether the recycled fish were marked.
They were marked, and I want to say one of them returned, one of the less than 10.
But were they marked in such a way that Bart would be able to tell?
Good question. Yeah. I think Greg and Elise and Bart spoke. I think they Floyd tagged them on both sides of the dorsal.
Okay.
Are you done?
All right.
Are you done with that part of it?
Lieberg, have been any counts from Lieberg because no fish have arrived.
So. Yeah.
Are you going to have the crew, the same crew as last year, where you were able to cover both sides and have a longer duration crew there?
The proposal I have right now, it'll of course depend on the last agenda item, puts a crew in there for starting to remove Lieberg hatchery steelhead as early as
Chinook.
I'm Chinook, as early as the middle of July, so pushing a month ahead. The difficulty was that in early years where large numbers of wild fish were coming back early, we would have had to have handled a large number of wild fish in order to pull out a small number of hatchery fish, but that's changed with relatively smaller numbers of wild fish. We should be able to do that safely by starting earlier using the procedures we kind of learned in 2015 and 16. That it just depends on staffing. It's in the plan.
Cool. All right, thanks, Cam. So that does it for updates. Before we move on to these last two items, Lance, while we've got you on the phone, could you just give us a little update from your end on where the Spring Chinook HGMPs are at? I know we were looking at addressing some of the comments that we got back a few months ago, but I haven't really heard much since then.
Yeah, and sorry for not kind of staying in the loop with you guys on kind of all the stuff that's been developing.
I know you've been busy.
Willamette stuff on other areas, but yeah, so we have the four Chinook HGMPs. Those are done and been submitted by your agencies. And last January 17, January 17, we had a public comment period for those Chinook HGMPs, and then kind of gave notice on what we're going to do NEPA-wise, our process that we have to do. And so we got some comments back. I can't remember the number, maybe 5 or 10 different comment letters on the Chinook HGMPs. And I haven't really worked through them. I think I forwarded them on to your guys' agencies, ODFW and the Corps. And so you should have those. But yeah, the next step in the process is we have to fulfill our NEPA stuff. And so we said we're going to do an EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, which is a pretty big deal. And so we're drafting that now, and so the next step will be releasing that EIS for public comment review. And so maybe this summer that would happen. So unfortunately, you know, our HGMP process is a long one because we have to work through so many different steps and public reviews and all of that. So, you know, probably we're looking at getting approval of the Chinook HGMPs probably next fiscal year, early next year. It'll kind of be best case scenario probably, just of all the things we have to jump through. But once we do that, you'll have kind of never-ending coverage of the HGMPs under the ESA, you know, unless something dramatic changes with the program. So I know there's a lot of interest to get approved HGMPs, and we're working on it. So, you know, maybe those that aren't familiar with all this stuff, what we've done is work to develop new HGMPs that look at integration of wild Chinook into the broodstock and all of that criteria. That was kind of the need to do new HGMPs. And So once we get them approved, it kind of pulls out the hatchery stuff from the existing 2008 buyout and gives a new authorization for those programs. So that's kind of the skinny on it.
Lance, do we have to address the comments that already came in, or are we looking more towards the comments that'll be on the draft EIS?
Yeah, usually, you know, we respond to all of the public comments, so I'll have to circle back around with this group when it comes time and work through all the comments and see if there's changes that we want to do to the HGMPs and all of that stuff. So maybe if you have those now, be looking at them and see from your point of view what are the things that may need to be changed in the HGMPs, the things we want to consider, do differently, whatever. So yeah, we have to do our due diligence to review all those comments and respond to them appropriately. We don't have to do like, you know, a formal release of how we responded to them at this point. It's just more for us to consider management-wise. And then the public will get another opportunity to comment on all the stuff when the EIS goes and it goes out. And typically what we do is we have a formal response to all the EIS comments that we include in that whole package.
Okay.
So I looked at all those comments when they first came in, you know, a couple months ago, and haven't really looked at them since. But yeah, we need to kind of group together at some point and talk through them.
Okay. Yeah, I breezed through a couple of them myself, but didn't really spend much time compiling any response or thoughts about them. So yeah, I guess just let us know when you want to get the band back together and go through them.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Cool. Thanks, Lance.
You bet.
Okay, so the next thing we had on here was the 2017 adult return disposition review. Cam, you sent me the draft disposition spreadsheet a couple weeks ago.
Shouldn't have been anything major changes from previous years. I think so.
Yep, it looked pretty similar to stuff we've seen before. I think you mentioned we needed to maybe cross-check some of the broodstock collection numbers with the HGMPs. What we have in the HGMPs now that we've kind of fine-tuned some of those survival rates and pre-spawn mortalities and all that stuff.
I think I did that.
You did? Okay.
And they all matched, I think. This was a month ago. I don't remember what I had for breakfast.
I think I saw an email from you that you had provided some.
Oh, good.
Double checked.
Yep. The HGMPs compared to the disposition table for stock collection.
Yeah. Cool. Sounds good. Well, then, as far as you guys are concerned, is that pretty much final? Ready to roll with it?
You had some adjustments that you feel strongly about.
No, I did not. Do we normally send that out to like the WFPOM group and kind of the larger Willamette region?
We didn't have the WFPOM group
right
the last time we did it. It just goes to the HMT. But yeah, if you want to, I guess that's the process now. The HMT reports to the WFPOM.
Yeah.
If they have an interest in knowing what we say we're going to do, go for it.
Yeah, I was just kind of thinking, like, if it's done, then let's let people know and we can send it out to that group and say, here it is. That's what we're rolling with.
With the big caveat of unknown spring snow runs for 2017.
Yeah.
The last time we had less than 1,000 fish by the end of April was 2008, and every fishery was shut down and every hatchery was scrambling for every single fish. It was
three fish.
Yeah.
Are all three of those males? Or
they're
all.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. They're 100% hatchery.
100% hatchery.
Yep. Yeah.
We got to start anyway.
Yeah. Oh, that brings up another thing that I was thinking of recently. I don't know if you guys have this. I know we've done it on the Columbia in a number of places, but a priority list for when adults return as far as, I mean, some of those hatcheries on the Columbia, we're looking at a number of different programs funded through a number of different agencies occurring at one place, but I don't know if we have that for the Willamette as far as prioritizing brood for, you know, the Corps mitigation program or outplants up above dams or broodstock for programs like the Malala or the SAFE program and things like this. But it might be, we don't have that, it might be useful to have kind of a priority list of when we do have low returns, this is kind of where we spend our fish that are available. Do you guys have something like that internally? Or
And explicitly, I thought it was in the HGMPs that we have prioritization right now in place where brood's first priority, O planting is second, tribes, sales,
gleaners, food banks.
Food banks. So broodstock and O plant fish have the top priority, but the broodstock use for non-mitigation fish hasn't been split out of the broodstock need. So that
right.
would be what you'd be interested in having as the core up. So what portion, because see, it kind of, you have to get a balance between broodstock for the mitigation program and the number of fish available for outplanting. And if in a bad year, do we simply only take brood for mitigation fish and the full complement of outplant fish, or do we adjust the outplant fish to make broodstock available for non-mitigation parts of the programs? And that is well above me on the food chain to make that decision.
Sure.
I don't know whether we're going to see it this year or not. It's quite likely. I'll come up with that answer.
Yeah, so there's a prioritization scheme in the HGMPs, like Cam says, and if there's issues with that and how it's described, we definitely need to change that now rather than later. So when you get a moment, look through that and make sure it meets the needs.
Yeah, I know we had a prioritization list for surplus returns. And within that surplus return list, I know we had broodstock for other programs like SAFE, Moala, etc. But I don't know if those were listed out specifically, or if, and this is where I need to go back and look, but if we had looked at, okay, if we don't have enough fish for broodstock and mitigation programs and and outplants, do we do a mix of both, and what does that look like? Do we want to keep perpetuating the program at the current level and skimp on outplanting for a year, or do we want to maintain outplanting in some places and not? So I don't know if it dove down to that level of detail in the HGMP.
No, it just prioritizes full broodstock need as highest priority, and the broodstock need is what's identified as, you know, your broodstock collection in the HGMP.
Okay, and that would just be then for, well, no,
which I think
it's
would
not.
Answer your, it would answer your, I mean, broodstock collection would be for the hatchery mitigation program would take priority over outplanting if you looked at those two.
Right. Well, mm-hmm. that's a given.
But I think that was the question Andy just posed, right? Would we take fewer broods for the hatchery program to continue outplanting? And I think based on the HGMP, the answer would be no. The HGMP prioritization.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the issue comes up, like, if your brood stock is so low where, like, I think South Sinian's probably, or no, I guess it's North Sinian now, where you want to fill your program in basin first and foremost, but they also collect fish for the Malala program, whether that gets downsized in order to meet some outplanting goals that are reduced also. That's kind of, I think, where you're talking, Andy, and getting into that extra layer of detail for non-mitigation programs outside the population area, right?
Yeah, that's a little bit more of what I'm getting at. Just because we may have to answer those questions later on this year, so it'd be better to think about them now.
So Cam, I kind of heard it. Is the forecast looks fairly decent. Fall counts are low, but so is water temperature. Is ODFW thinking it's going to be another 2007-2008?
ODFW. I think we have a full suite of beliefs out there for what's going to happen. I'm not very optimistic at all. I don't think it's the water temperatures are that cold. They're sitting at 50 instead of 52. Tom, I think, is weighing in saying, no, they could be just delayed. That's what his thinking is. There could be stacks of them down below. They're the catch of Chinook below Willamette Falls, above the mouth of the Willamette, is sitting at about nearly 800 fish now, which is, oh, I'd say a third of the recent average by this time. So the catch is actually low, but it's not as low as the count would indicate, the run size is. So we just have to wait and see.
Yeah.
We probably only have to wait a couple weeks. Before the next HMT meeting, we will definitely know whether we're screwed or not.
Yeah.
Well, when we get those warm days for several days, and the ambient air seems to, with flows going down, I don't know what the snow coming off is going to do.
It's related to run size, timing. We had talked about an April talk, just check in on the Middle Fork.
So that was, we did that.
Okay.
The count's three. What's the update to be? What am I supposed to say? So we had that, and we said, we're going to wait for 2 weeks, and we're going to meet again in 2 weeks. You're welcome to join in on the call. It was not a pleasant call.
Uh-huh. Hey, at least the count isn't behind anymore by the early days.
Yeah.
Pretty easy to update it when your number is zero.
Yeah, I mean, what do you guys think? What? You were on the call. In 2 weeks, we'll have a better idea of how visible it is or whether it's not as visible.
We got our truck drivers on board, so I, of course, you know this is happening.
Yeah, sorry.
But we can train them for next year, right? We have to.
Next year isn't going to be any better. If you consider that pessimistically, this is a collapse right now. A collapse will always last at least 2 years. And that puts us in a possibility of having a decent run size in 2019 next. That's the next time we're likely to get, where it's possible to get a large run size, if in fact the run collapsed from fours and fives this year. So. You're looking askance. And Lance, you said run size looks or the forecast looks okay, but in recent history, the forecast has always been biased high. In 2016, the forecast was, I believe, 50,000. We got 35 or 40,000, something like that. This year, the forecast was 30,000. If that's accurate, then yeah, run size is abysmal. But if in fact that's another biased high forecast and run size is actually closer to 20,000, then things become difficult. So.
Yeah, I know. My opinion is we're probably right in that transition where you don't want to be forecast wise, where the run is going down and you always overestimate, and then when it improves, you underestimate. So there's always that lag time. And we're probably right in that period where we don't know if it's continuing to go down or it's going to rebound a little bit. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
But I'll send out the spreadsheet for the gentleman's bet HMT poll on Willamette Falls count. And we can all have fun with that.
It was a... Ricardo Walker and Rich Piaskowski tasked me with going back and looking at all Chinook returns going to the 70s and model what we'd expect to see under different scenarios for monthly counts of the Willamette Falls. So I've been playing with that for the last several weeks, and it's not a happy scenario at all. So.
All right. Okay, so to wrap this one up, Cam, do you want to distribute the disposition spreadsheet then to the larger Willamette FPOM group?
Yeah, sure.
Cool.
Actually, Bernadette usually handles that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Make it happen.
Awesome, thank you. And then I'll look back at those HGMPs at that prioritization list and kind of see exactly what it says, and then if we need to dive in a level further, maybe I'll take a stab at some way to organize that or rank it.
Okay.
We can shop it around this group and kind of see what folks think. All right.
I've got an angling question.
Sure.
Does ODFW have some kind of number that if fish don't come back at, you know, as predicted, they close, close angling.
What's the number? I don't know that. It's probably pretty fluid, and based on a conversation from the district bios and the Clackamas County people, I might get dragged into it.
You say 2008 was
2008.
They close angling, sure. Or they did?
Yeah, closed angling and everywhere. And that year, if I remember correctly, we did have a little over 875 fish over the falls by the end of April.
Was there a two-year lag there, too, Cameron?
It looks to me like there is. Which is a two-year parcel, not lag. It's
parcel. Yeah, 2 years of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's predicated on there being some recovery. Right now, it looks like the last I read is that we're entering another El Nino. It's a new El Nino in the East Pacific for 2017. So where would recovery have happened? We have a continuous El Nino ocean conditions plus the blob for the last 5 years.
The blob is dying in Alaska and massive numbers and all that.
So. It's actually fine. It's fine because I figure I want to retire when we have lots of fish.
Yeah.
So 5 years out, numbers are going to be really ramping. Well, I mean, I can take some credit for that, and then I'm gone.
Looks like success.
The annual oscillation point right now that anybody knows about or whatever.
I haven't tracked it. Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that one? Nope. Okay. So the last one we had on here was hatchery M&E funding issues and prioritization, and I threw this on here because, like I mentioned earlier, we're having shortfalls in our budget right now as far as the funding that we would normally apply to task orders issued July 1st to the state. So Cam, remind me, because your guys' task order is a little bit different and your funding extends to October instead of expiring 30 June, I think.
Sure. Karen Daly, 4 years ago during our negotiations for the cooperative agreement that I've been operating under, told us in no uncertain terms that we can't be required to produce reports without having an active contract.
Right.
So in order to
Makes
do
sense.
That, if a report is provided to the Corps by August and there's a 6 month or 4 month lag in the review back and forth cycle, then the project had to be technically alive.
Sure.
For that interval. I'm assuming that's changed now based on this and the market survey. The new time interval is April to April.
Hmm.
Right? Is that right?
That's still pretty flexible. The contract quotes have been kind of confused. They think it has to be, like, whenever we award it, it has to be a 1 year cycle, but we could set a period of performance for whenever. We can award it early and have the work start later on. We can change when reports are due and when review periods are, so it's not necessarily locked into April.
Flexible.
But that extension of your guys' work does not cover this field season that goes through the summer of 2017. That's just the report writing and review period is why it extends to October of
right.
this year.
Those were core guidelines.
Okay. Yep.
I don't think we're married to them. I mean, our preference would be to have a, I don't know, how about July 1 to June 30 so that we have a fiscal year?
Sure.
That'd be nice. That'd be nice. And that fits in well with the availability of the data and everything.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That scale.
But I was just asking because the new task order that would be awarded July 1st, which will be contract now, that is what funds your upcoming field season, right? Okay. Yeah. So our shortfall right now will then affect this coming summer and fall.
Right.
Okay. So that's what I thought, and it looks like we're short, so we won't have the normal amount of money available. So I worked with Rich a little bit to kind of line out, as we're building this contract, what we have to specify more directly what exactly we want done instead of just saying, hey, go do M&E go do good things. So in doing that, kind of breaking out the different tasks that have been performed in the past, and trying to prioritize those around different management objectives, and looking at what are the most important management objectives for everybody, and what are the most important tasks that kind of meet those management objectives or help answer those questions, and are there ways to perform those tasks that are cheaper or more cost effective, or some tasks that we could do every other year and it wouldn't hurt us to necessarily skip a year, or do maybe more select sampling in certain areas, cover less of a time period, or just sample more frequently. So I just wanted to bring that to this group, to the HMT group, to just have a little bit of discussion about what you guys feel like is most important to look at this year, and if you had any opinions on how to orchestrate these objectives or priorities. Some of you probably seen it, but Rich sent out a paper to the Armony group yesterday, I think, that kind of listed out some of these things. So we'll discuss it in that venue a little bit more once folks have had some time. But
so the way this shapes up, it looks to me, is that you want it set up so that it's sub-basin by sub-basin. Within each sub-basin, a set of tasks, that are M&E tasks for that sub-basin.
Yep.
And then you wanted the R&E group to prioritize those objectives, or even down to the task level by sub-basin, so that we can somehow create a bottom line, a place where we can draw the line and say, if the prioritization goes from 1 through 5 and we've got funding for up to 4, then 5 is gone. That's kind of the simplistic view of it. Is that what you had in mind?
Yeah, and ultimately, like, I can make the decision, or Tammy can make the decision, but ultimately I'd like everyone to be involved in, if we have to cut something, what gets cut? If we have to keep something that's absolutely critical, what needs to stay? So yeah, exactly, Cam. I think you pretty much summarized it.
So the process for the RMA team is, they're going to have this done within a month, I think. I doubt they'll have it done in time for the next meeting.
Oh yeah, that's not the intent. I think Rich asked for comments back on the May 4th or something. So a little bit of time to review it before the Armony meeting, and then hopefully discussion at that meeting. If folks feel like these are the wrong objectives or the wrong metrics to collect for those objectives. We'll talk about kind of
there are just some things that it'll come up in the Armony meeting. The specific items that are built into the program, like the operation of the Bennett video counting station, Lieberg trapping operations and Lieberg video counts. They're not in here explicitly. They're implicitly there. If I'm reading this right, there is still a continued need to have some idea of the number of fish coming back to the river. So.
Yep, so that would be helping to answer the run timing question, right?
So, yeah, I haven't had enough time. This came up.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, I know. I just wanted to just kind of shop it around.
So you could do something for me. You could track down whether there was any traction from Martin Learman. Rich asked Martin to assemble some well thought out ways of looking at survey intensity and the effects that might have on accuracy and precision of our data. I haven't heard anything from Martin. I would have expected to have gotten some questions from him if he was actively working on it, but I haven't. Mm-hmm. For my part, I touched base with our long-term experts, including Kurt Schroeder, and we can arguably have a stratified survey intensity where early in the season we switch from what's been a 10-day survey rotation to a 4, which is effectively a 7-day survey rotation. All surveys happen within a 4-day interval within a 7-day week. Mm-hmm. We generally manage to get everything done in that week with some cleanup the following week, but always within 10 days. But we can stretch that for June, July, and August to a 14-day rotation, which decreases the number of carcasses we capture or recover, but should give us a good idea of the number of reds that are constructed, because the red life is always longer than 2 weeks, always. So that should be okay, and then switch to a 10-day rotation at the peak of the season, go back to the normal protocol for the month of September, early into October. That decreases the number of EVAs that are necessary by 2,
which is significant. Two people over 4 months is.
Yeah.
And decreases the need for a vehicle, and I've got some ideas.
Okay.
But the trouble is that I had anticipated having somebody like Martin do this with some expertise. I'm doing this off the cuff based on professional judgment.
Sure.
He would use arithmetic. It would have been nice to have that.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'll check back with Rich and Martin and see if they've made any headway there.
Okay. The draft budgets I have cover the range from full funding for everything I want to have happen down to I'm looking for another job.
Mm-hmm.
It's very handy to have a number to work off of a target, but we haven't received anything like that from you guys.
I know, I don't have anything.
So I'm stuck in this suite, this range of potential budgets I could propose.
Yeah.
But I need to know what the work order is going to look like.
Sure. Yeah, and I'll try to get you something as soon as I can, but I don't have any more information than as far as the number goes.
So what do you need from us, and what's the timeline?
Well, as far as what I would like from ODFW and NIMS and the whole region is just a prioritization of those different tasks. And if you feel like we're missing tasks or some don't belong in there, let me know that too.
Sure. Why don't you bring this up, because I love bringing it up.
Yeah.
Estimate the annual proportion of natural influence. PNI. Why is that in there?
Rich actually added that in there. I had PHOS and PNOB. Of course,
well,
PNOB right now is zero. So it's pretty easy to calculate.
Been zero for 4 years.
Yeah.
So because PNI is PNOB, for the brood 4 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That's always zero for the next 4 years.
Right.
So P and I is zero. So okay, I've done that and it's free. Zero.
Done for a while.
That's
right.
Gone. So that comes off the list. Great.
Yeah. So I kind of struggled with should we even have that one in there right now? It's not necessarily applicable, but if it was applicable and looking forward to the future, I just don't want to have this prioritization for 1 year. I want to have it and be able to use it for a number of years going forward. Where does that fall in the list?
Well, I was thinking more in terms of the fact that it has to be focused on what's needed in real time, because you're never going to come up with a perfect system that can be just implemented every single year, rotating panel design or anything, without there being
sure.
some need for adjustments, adaptive management.
Sure.
The PNI issue is a non-issue for the next 4 years in all four sub-basins, because no wild fish have been taken into brood for 4 years.
Yeah.
So.
And probably won't be until.
It's not going to happen until next year.
Yeah.
Under what was, Lance, you said, best case scenario.
Right.
We'll have this done for next year. Which means that in 2022, we will start thinking about the influence of PNI on well-being of wild fish.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay. We'll work on this.
Cool.
May 4th.
What I am imagining as far as constructing a contract is that you'd have kind of a skeleton set of tasks that are accomplished every year. These are critical. These are the metrics you're going to collect every year. And then you would have options within that contract to add meat onto that skeleton with additional tasks, with additional analysis. That you could exercise those options. And that would allow some flexibility funding-wise, so when we don't get as much funding as we think, then we don't exercise those options, and if we're fully funded, then we exercise them. And some of these things may be more like biannual or every 5 years or every 10 years, less frequently than an annual collection. So gotta take that into account as well.
Yeah, I anticipated a rotating panel design for some of the survey reaches that would have come from Martin, which was his expertise in his published work.
Right.
Showing how the rotating panel design can be effective at getting long-term trend data at a much lower cost if you do it right.
Sure.
The trick is doing it right. But you want a skeleton
Yeah, I mean, and that's how I kind of have to present this stuff, because I'm the one that's going to go back in and kind of work this into a contract form. So so far as building the contract, yeah, I'm kind of like a skeleton, and then 2, 3, maybe 4 different options of stuff that you could add on to that base level of monitoring every single year. And so having some of those tasks prioritized is how we can go about doing that.
Okay.
But basically, I just wanted to kind of explain the situation to you guys as far as funding that'll be awarded 2017, July 1st. It's going to be less, and I don't know how much less, but it's going to be less than what we had last year. So.
Yeah, my preferred budget is less than last year.
Okay.
But
well, that helps.
Preferred budget? Wow.
Yeah.
Your preferred budget is less than last year.
It means I have fewer UBAs. I know this doesn't come up very often, but I get really tired of having 20 people knocking on my door all the time. 22.
Yeah.
With 3 or 4, you're thinking 3 or 4 kind of options. I'm just trying to get it in my head how this could come together. It's going to be a baseline monitoring framework, and then identify specific aspects of the monitoring program that otherwise wouldn't get funded, but if money's available, it would happen.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, we could have 6, 7 options if we needed it. I kind of doubt that we would go that far. And some of these things are, I mean, you kind of have to do you have to meet a certain threshold to just get those baseline data. And once you've already done your, you know, spawning surveys, for instance, then, well, you already have data on this and this and this because you're already out there, you're collecting it. So some of those things are just like, well, the data is collected, but maybe we don't analyze it and include it in the report. And then the option would be, yeah, you do that analysis, then you do include it in the report. Or you go kind of above and beyond and look at other things. So just kind of wanted to explain the situation and get you guys thinking about that stuff. Lance, do you have any thoughts on like reduced M&E or M&E prioritization for future years?
Yeah, I'm sure I will. So let me make sure I'm understanding this right. So usually the baseline hatchery M&E is all covered under O&M funding, and typically in the past in the RM&E group, we never really saw that stuff. But now Rich had sent it out to the RM&E group and wants review of the hatchery baseline funding or that contract now. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
And there's pretty good overlap between HMT and the RM&E group, but I want everybody's eyes to get on this. And it makes sense for the folks that are looking at research to know what is the baseline M&E that's also occurring.
Yeah,
so you're not totally out of the loop. But yeah, that's the idea.
As folks review this...
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lance.
No, go ahead.
As folks review this, be aware that the document that Rich released yesterday does alter kind of the structure of who performs some of the in-hatchery monitoring. The way it's laid out now is the way this is proposing. This is proposing that the hatchery staff manage much of the kind of on-the-ground sampling without as much support from us, basically, from the RM&E group. So I would not be putting 2 EBAs on site at each hatchery routinely for any fish handling. That's not going to happen anymore. Somehow, they have to be there at some point, but it won't be as intensive.
Wait, can you explain that to me, Cam?
Well, this first part for the management objectives, you say in here, if I'm reading this right, not included in the hatchery RM&E program, specifically a description of in-hatchery survival rates, disease prevalence, releases, abundance of and condition of fish that are released, collection timing of fish at the hatcheries and traps, and the disposition and timing of fish that are spawned or outplanted, and then sampling of tissues and scales from the fish that are handled at the various traps. That's generally handled by my staff now, or certainly my staff helping.
So aside,
less available.
So aside from the last one, it seems like all those things are just kind of like automatically collected by hatchery staff, you know, mortality rates by month and broodstock collected and when you're spawning and when you're out planting.
But I'm assuming that all of that material still has to come in to the reporting. Or not? It wasn't clear from the... If it just evaporates from the annual report, so no more reporting on size, timing, and numbers of fish released?
I don't think it would evaporate from the annual report, but I guess we just wanted to make it clear that some of that stuff is going to be a requirement of like the O&M hatchery contract, where they will report, we collected this many fish on this date, and we spawned this many fish on this date. Kind of the regular generated hatchery reports from Greg and Brett and all those guys.
Okay.
So some of that stuff will come from them, but it'll be data that'll be provided to the M&E contractor via the government. And so it won't necessarily be a responsibility of that contractor to collect those metrics. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Because you really have to spell out like what you're responsible to collect and what you're not. Mm-hmm. And if the government's going to provide anything, you have to say that. So aside from like the tissue collection and sampling, is that something that hatchery staff normally do, or is that something that your guys do?
Well, Greg's guys do that normally for at least half the season up in the North San Juan title.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, we do it all on the South San Juan and on the McKenzie. But now that the McKenzie outplanting effort is focused on later in the season, then that it doesn't happen throughout the whole course of the season now. So. Mm. Could be made to work. I'm a little. I will still receive all of these data one way or the other, or the contractor will receive all mm-hmm. of these data and somehow it'll be archived or it'll be written up.
Yeah.
It just won't be collected necessarily by folks answering to the contractor.
Sure.
Go
ahead, Lance.
The management objectives that are listed, those six, I haven't really looked at it in not much detail, but if there are others that we think are important, can we comment on that and include them in there, or is it pretty much just this six?
Yeah, please. If you have other objectives you think need to be included, totally. Add them in there.
Okay. All right. One thing that comes to mind right off the top is kind of what the status of the funding of the pedigree studies is. So I don't know if there would be opportunity to kind of give that update at next week at the RM&E meeting, kind of where that's at. Because in my mind, that kind of factors into some of this stuff.
Okay. I can ask Rich about that, but that, yeah, I'm not really plugged into what they're doing as far as pedigree study funding goes.
There's a little discomfort with having no presence in the watershed above Cougar or above Detroit. If there's a management objective to estimate the proportion of hatchery origin spawners by subbasin, but we're not present above Detroit where hatchery spawners spawn.
Mm-hmm.
That means that the metrics are only going to be related to the below dam surveys, which is still useful.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not comprehensive.
So you were thinking it'd be useful to do spawning surveys to calculate PHAS above Detroit?
If you want to calculate PHAS for a subbasin and spawning mm-hmm. occurs above and below the dam, then surveys should happen above and below the dam.
Right.
But if it's informative enough just to know what PHAS is below the dam and assume no influence or whatever from fish that spawn above the dam.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, wouldn't we know, since we're outplanting those fish up above the dam, we would know exactly how many were collected.
How many outplanted, yeah. We never know how many actually spawn. It's
right.
Pretty safe in the North San Juan in a normal year to assume low pre-spawning mortality.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case above McKenzie. Above South Fork McKenzie, the range has been from nothing to 65% mortality over the 10, 12 years of data.
Yeah.
About right? the range is 65% pre-spawn mortality in 2009 or something like that to zero in 2015. We have a presence in the Middle Fork because of other contracts with the Corps, so that's not an issue there, but it'd be a real issue a few years down the road if we didn't have a survey up there, because that has an incredibly fluid pre-spawn mortality rate up there.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that I had in there originally, was kind of an evaluation and a monitoring of that outplanting program, just kind of looking at, okay, we outplant fish, and are we successful in having them spawn, and where do they spawn, red distribution, abundance, all that kind of stuff. And I think that's beneficial in some regard, but if we do have good data on it in the past and we know the variability, and if we have a number of years of decent data, then do we need to do more until something changes? And that was Rich's point and one of the reasons that I took it out of there. But I'm definitely open to discussions on including back in, because I see outplanting as part of kind of routine hatchery operations that O&M folks fund. So it makes sense to monitor it.
Yeah.
All right.
So, Andy, is there the option of using this O&M funding for monitoring above the dam? Is that a possibility?
I think so. It's always kind of been broken up where below dam stuff is funded by O&M and above dam stuff has still been quote unquote research. And so it's been CRFM funded. But at some point, you know, we make the transfer where it's no longer research and this is a routine program and it's funded by O&M. So I think there's kind of a gray area there where we can start to, O&M funding can start to inherit some of those tasks.
Those will be provided as options. I mean, that's an option. That, mm-hmm. something that would be laid out.
That would make sense, yeah. All right. Any other thoughts on that one from anybody? Okay. One last thing before we wrap up. I got an email from Mr. Rich Paskowski. And he said, Armini Group discussed the issue of mismark rates in the South Sandium last month, recognizing the 10 to 30% unmarked adult Chinook transported above foster were actually unmarked hatchery origin returns. So the question from the Armini team to HMT was, is South Sandium hatchery using the same protocols for marking as used in the Columbia River hatcheries or within the larger Willamette system? And other improvements that can be made to the marking procedures that reduce the mismark rate?
Yes. So back, Andy provided some comments on the 2014 annual report, including a critique on what might be causing high mismark rates, basically, in the South Sandiam. And in the past, when you get a big difference in the number of, in the size of the hatchery program, so you got a large hatchery program and a small wild run, then a very small mismark rate on your hatchery program can then translate into a large proportion of the wild fish or unclipped fish that are in fact not wild. And that's true, and we know that happened. But your arithmetic in the review of the report showed that would have to be a very large mismark rate for it to actually have resulted in a 20% mismark or unclipped hatchery fish passage at South Sandiam in 2015 and a 30% in 2016. So we ended up chatting with Ryan and the staff at Willamette Hatchery, and it turns out that the broods contributing to the returns in 2016 and 17 were hand-clipped, not auto-clipped. It should have been auto-clipped, but they were largely hand clipped because the Coda Wire tag group is fairly small in that group. So all the Coda Wire tag fish got auto trailer clipped, and the remaining releases were hand clipped, and then apparently did a poor job. So that's over, because for all subsequent broods, they've all been auto clipped, auto trailer clipped.
Yep.
So starting in 2000, maybe this year, but certainly in 2018, the mismark rate would go back to the background, which is about 5%. And I think that will happen either this year or next year.
And what were you saying, Cam? What brood years were those that were anything that didn't have a seed?
2011 and 2012.
Okay. And potentially anything before that, right? I mean, anything before that would have been hand marked before we implemented mass marking via auto trailer.
Right.
So okay. It wasn't necessarily that something changed that year, it was that the new protocol hadn't been implemented.
Gotcha. Well, that makes sense. So right now, are we using the automatic trailers to clip every fish in the Willamette?
I think I can safely say 100% of all spring chinook in the upper Willamette.
Okay, so we're not hand clipping?
Correct. I mean, there may be some small nuances, but I believe that to be true.
Okay.
Yeah, if the machine kicks out a fish because of a misclip, it gets hand clipped.
Right, yeah.
Sure.
But that's a tiny fraction.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're looking this year to see a dramatic decrease in the misclip fish passage at Foster, and certainly next year.
Cool.
Yeah, so from a practice standpoint, that's been 3 years or whatever that's been resolved.
Okay.
We're seeing the outcome of past practice.
Cool. Well, that's an easy answer and a good answer.
Yeah.
And what did you estimate your mismark rate of those hand clips for brood year 11 and 12 were?
I didn't look, I'm sorry. It would be online. I could check that and make a note.
Like 10, 20% or something?
Probably 5 or 6%, really. That's 5 or 6 times the normal misclip rate from an auto trailer. Probably.
Oh,
yeah. I can actually look that up. We've got the data for that. Mm-hmm. The reason it was so difficult to resolve was that these fish were at Willamette Hatchery, and nothing like this happened with returning adults from the Willamette Hatchery program. It just doesn't.
Right.
But the Willamette Hatchery fish were always auto, for those years, were auto trader marked.
Hmm.
It was specifically the South Santiam fish before they got transferred back to the South Santiam that were largely hand clipped.
Okay. That makes sense.
Then we finally made a push, got a second auto marking trailer, and now both trailers end up at Willamette for that Chinook marking period.
Cool. And so we discovered that kind of abnormality, I guess, of high PHAS in a place where we thought we were only putting natural working fish because we were doing otoliths sampling, right? For adults that were outplanted up there from spawning surveys.
But
so
I have funding from CRFM to continue, well, I don't have it. I will probably receive funding from CRFM to perform the South Santiam surveys this year too.
Okay.
So
anyways, my point is, I think it's good. There's obviously we've seen some benefits of doing those from above dams, so that's just one case where, yeah, it was nice to have that info. Okay, that's all I've got on the agenda. Does anybody else here have anything else they want to bring up or discuss? Sarah, thanks for joining us today and providing your expertise. And Jeremy, thanks for sitting in as well.
I'm a sponge today.
Cool. Anybody else on the phone? Any last comments? All right.
I'm good.
Go ahead, Lance.
I guess at some point our agencies need to chat about summer steelhead program, HGMP, notice of intent to sue us, all those things.
Yeah, for sure.
We can do that separately.
Yeah, it's coming to a head. Yeah, I'll send you an email later this week or maybe next week and follow up.
All right, sounds good.
Cool.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for joining. Talk to you later.
Bye.
See you.
Where is our meeting?